This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Debates about climate change and the environment often focus, understandably, on risk evaluation, mitigation, and adaptation. Important research is dedicated to technological innovations like carbon capture or renewable energy, adaptive strategies to protect biodiversity, or financial solutions to bolster sustainable investment. This work is important, of course, but in order to get to the root of the current climate crisis, it is equally important to question the role that we, human beings, occupy in the living world and to radically rethink our relationship with other living beings. This project is at the heart of the work of Professor Corinne Peluchon, whom we are delighted to welcome to Vis-a-Vis. Corinne Peluchon is a professor of philosophy at Gustave Eiffel University. She specializes in moral and political philosophy and in medical, environmental, and animal ethics, addressing themes such as ecology and our relationship to nature, eco-anxiety, vulnerability, and democracy. Corinne Peluchon, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Hello.
So we'll start perhaps with your book called Enlightenment in the Ecological Age, which was published by Ethics International Press last year, and which can be read in some ways as a defense of Enlightenment values and principles seen through the lens of the living world. Such a defense is needed, you argue, because the legacy of the Enlightenment is attacked on two fronts. On the one hand, by anti-Enlightenment forces rooted in nationalist, anti-intellectual views of the world, and on the other hand, by a postmodern relativist ideology that contests the Enlightenment's universal and universalist scope. Perhaps to start with, can you explain a little bit more what you try to achieve in this book and why the Enlightenment has come under such heavy criticism? And what is needed, really, to defend it?
Yes. Well, first, it would be interesting to say that the Enlightenment is less a century or a continent than an attitude, as Michel Foucault said, which consists in considering one's present as the object of all critical thinking in order to try to reorient the future. So the future is not fixed. The Enlightenment is a way of understanding what are the challenges and the dangers we are confronted with and what kind of guidelines we could provide. So the Enlightenment is an ongoing process which can interest each continent, each epoch. But of course, there are some principles that constitute the core principle of the Enlightenment, which is an intellectual structures, which is connected with a political project. And these four principles are autonomy, so the value of the critical thinking, to the equality of human beings who can exert their critical thinking to get rid of some prejudices. So, and it this is connected with the project of a democratic society and the value of reason as a tool to help us emancipate ourselves. And of course, the idea that humanity has a unity, which is expressed in human rights. So I think that these four principles, which are attacked by anti-Enlightenment, still make sense. But it's true that we have maybe to reconfigure some of them. For instance, the importance of autonomy does make sense, but what I have done is to take or corporeality seriously and to focus on the fact that we depend upon nature and other beings, and that our vulnerability is also something which help us reframe, reconfigure our autonomy, which is not to be reduced to a mere independence. The same with human rights, because the other human beings are not the... Of course, we have to set limits or right to do whatever we please for the sake of other human beings, but other species, and even for me, other sentient beings, other animals considered as individual beings, their interests are to be taken seriously in order to build a just society. So there is an issue of justice toward animals, other speakers, and other generations, future generation. And this shows that if we want to continue to foster the principles that are the core of enlightenment today in such a context, we have to overcome the dualism between nature and culture, human beings and animals, and not to forget the importance of the freedom of will, but to understand freedom, which is transformed in light of our corporality and our interconnectedness. And I think the focus on human condition, the fact that we all need food, water, are dependent upon other beings, the fact that we all are mortal and that we are born and that we have always an impact upon other beings when we eat and so forth. These are universal structures which can be applied in different contexts. And of course, some parts of our identity are socially constructed, but we have a human condition, and this human condition, this materiality of our existence, the fact that we, ecology is the wisdom of our dwelling on the earth, that we depend upon others, these are far-reaching consequences. And for instance, starting from the fact that we eat, that we live from water, food, and so forth, and that we always have an impact upon animals and other beings when we eat, this means that the protection of the biosphere, which is a condition of our existence, justice toward animals and future generations, become new duties of the states, which as not to be reduced to security between us or the reduction of inequalities. So I think that it's important to take into account the collapse of enlightenment after Auschwitz, Hiroshima, and the reversal of progress into regression in the 20th century. It's very important to listen to what postmodernist has to say, but we cannot be satisfied with the rejection of any universalizable ideal. And this is why I promote an ecological enlightenment.
And I mean, you put your finger on this in your book when you talk about the schéma de la domination, the domination schema, which in a way, as you explain, is a form of corruption, of dévoiement, as you would say in French, of rationality.
Yeah.
Is it also a corruption of freedom at the same time? Is the result of this process also a form of renunciation to our fundamental freedom, which perhaps also creates a sense of responsibility towards the rest of the living being?
Yes, we could say that this like that. It's true that to focus on our corporeality and dependence upon nature and other beings drives us into acknowledging that our freedom is reconfigured in light of our responsibility, which is huge because of our technological means and the fact that our modes of production and our modes of life and our technologies have an impact which goes further than our present life, and that we can also harm beings whose face we do not see and who do not yet exist. So, and how is it possible to feel responsible when we do not see the face of the one upon which we inflict harm. So I think this is very challenging. But it's true that for me, of course, in order to achieve the ecological transition, we have to change some structural, we have to foster some structural changes, especially in economy and the modes of production in agriculture and so forth. But I do insist upon the self-transformation which is required. And this self-transformation is not only intellectual. It also means that we uproot the scheme of domination. This self-transformation requires an enlargement of the self so that we deeply feel that we are not an empire within an empire and that the well-being of others are part of our well-being. And so I have tried to describe all the elements of this self-transformation, which is intellectual, but also whose key is the reconciliation of our nature with our begotten nature. I think that we, in our human condition, have a lot of resources to gain this maturity, which is required in order to set limits. Mm-hmm. To all right to do whatever we please, and to have a relationship with others, including animals, which is not as violent. Mm-hmm. And I think that aggressivity and violence toward beings which are reduced to corporeality, such as women, such as animals, is due to the fact that we reject our corporeality, or that we cannot stand the idea that we are mortal. And I think that this is one of the reasons why we have so many difficulties mm-hmm. to live in peace with others and to have a relationship with nature and other beings, which is not like a war.
And is that why phenomenology is so important to you? Because it seems to me that it brings together the two aspects that you mentioned, the intellectual process whereby we can take a step back and become self-critical in terms of our own position with regards to the world. But at the same time, phenomenology engages us to return to things themselves and therefore to a much more intimate and perhaps even more emotional relationship with the world and our existence as bodies.
Yes, we could say that. It's true that the phenomenological approach is not a third discourse, a discourse in the third person. Mm-hmm. It's a discourse in the first person. And it's true that if environmental ethics did not succeed in changing our lifestyles nor policies, in spite of its creativity, its ability mm-hmm. to provide guidelines, the notion of intrinsic value, ecocentrism, and so forth, why did it not succeed to change our lifestyles and economic structures? Maybe because it was a little bit abstract and because there is this discrepancy between theory and practice. And it is true that a lot of people are aware of the dangers of climate change, know what we could do. There are a lot of reports which testify to the abilities we have to change our economies and so forth. But at the individual and collective level, we do not change a lot of things. And in order to reduce this gap between behavior and consciousness or theory and practice, we have to maybe understand the importance of the experience of nature. Mm-hmm. And we have to focus on the concrete motivations of people. And this goes beyond phenomenology. But phenomenology, because it goes, it's the emotion, maybe moral traits which are required to have another relationship with others, which is not a relationship of dominion and so forth. But the phenomenological approach for me is very important because first, when it's a phenomenology of corporeality, it provides some universalizable guidelines For instance, I spoke of eating, which shed lights upon all relational condition, the fact that we always have an impact upon others, and including animals, and this has normative effects. And this is universalizable guidelines, but we can apply them in according to a diversity of context. And also, when we speak, like Anna Arendt, of the fact that we are born, I deepen this point. We are born in a world which is older than us, and which is larger than us, and which encompasses also the other beings and cultural and natural heritage. And in fact, this means that we live also for the world, not only for us. There is something which transcends our individual life.
Right. And in fact, this experience of the world that you describe, you analyze in great detail in your book, L'être et la mer pour un existentialisme écologique, Heading Out to Sea, an Ecological Existentialism. And I was really interested in this book in the way in which you decenter human beings away from the earth, the land,
yes,
and into the sea, in order, I understand, that's how I understood it, to force us to rethink how we engage with other living beings in a world that is, to some extent, unfamiliar. You give very concrete examples also of encounters with other living beings. For example, you describe how the oceanographer Anita Conti was transformed by looking into the eye of a shark. I mean, it's a fascinating passage in your book where, you know, you show that empathy actually emerged from, not so much from her observing the shark, but from the shark observing her. And then there's another example that you give invoking the writer Julio Cortázar, who has a short story about a man who comes face to face with axolotls, these small salamander-like creatures. He was in the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, and he saw them swimming in an aquarium. And you write, and I quote, "The gaze of the captive axolotls accuses the narrator and topples his conscience, so much so that he becomes himself in spirit an axolotl." How does this theory of ecological existentialism that you advocate for, how does it transform our relationship with animals? How does it help us reinvent the way in which we engage with other living beings?
First of all, the point in ecology is to decenter ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's quite difficult. Like a lot of people, I focused before on our terrestrial condition. That's right. Food, our dwelling on Earth, and so forth. But it was a kind of coexistentialism. But I had forgotten the sea. And, well, water is an element upon which we depend, and we are made of water, but we cannot live in water. Mm. Moreover, the sea is fascinating, but also we have a bivalent relationship with the sea, and it's associated in each culture with rebirth, but also with death, with danger, with motherhood. So, it's as bivalent as ourselves, Victor Hugo said. And for me, to head out and see, to understand nature, ourselves, not from our shore, but to understand us starting from the sea, completely changes our perspective and radically decenters ourselves. And the principle of the marine ontology I tried to develop was the unity of the ocean, because in the 40s there was an oceanographer who said that, well, of course we speak of different ocean, but in fact there is one ocean and it is before the land. So the land, well, all countries are not blocks of granite with water, but they are like islands. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to explore the the fact that our lands and our psyche are submersible. And I wanted to say that existentialism could be a resource, and it's paradoxical because existentialism focused on freedom, a project like Sartre, and they did not speak a lot about animals, except, well, there is an exception, Merleau-Ponty, which is a great philosopher, but he might not be happy to be called an existentialist. And it's true that in Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, our relationship with the others are characterized by conflictuality. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Well, but when we understand relationship with animals, it's true that sometimes there are some predators. When Val Plumhood explains that she was attacked by a crocodile. But it's rare. Most of the time, it's curiosity, or this kind of otherness that we encounter. And Anita Conti explains very, very well this idea of a being who is different, but who does not want to eat her, and also in Axolot, in the story of Julian Cortazar, it's, something which is very important for me, our responsibility toward other animals, and something they accuse us, even although they do not speak in a language we are able to understand, they accuse us. What are we doing? And these axolotls, they are in a box. They suffer, but they have a mute suffering. And the fact that he's able to suffer from their suffering changes his identity. And it's a very moving experience. And I think that this ecological existentialism I try to advocate is a journey in the sea. And of course, in order to reframe our relationship with animals, but it's true also that when we work in animal ethics, fishes are neglected, or axolotls, and I wanted also to speak of whales and so forth, and to say that there is an epiphany, the other animal as an otherness. It's not, he has an individuality, and he says, I cannot grasp him. Mm-hmm. And what he says to me is, don't kill me. So I think that for me it's very important, and I try to describe this.
Mm-hmm. And vulnerability is probably another keyword, central concept in your thinking. You, of course, quote Emmanuel Levinas and the way in which he conceives of the ethical relation as a relationship, the encounter with the infinite vulnerability of the other. I wonder whether vulnerability is also constitutive of our relationship with animals and with other living beings. And do you think that vulnerability is what creates our responsibility, or is it something more complex than this?
Yes.
Are we the wardens of the world, or is the relationship more reciprocal than what it appears?
Well, responsibility is a passivity in Levinas. Mm. So it's not an obligation, which is a consequence of something I've chosen, but it's a shock. Responsibility does not erase or exclude my selfhood. It's a contrary, it reframes my selfhood. My freedom is invested, he says. Mm-hmm. So it's not only conceived at the ability to make choices and to change them for me, but it's also an answer to a situation, and it's an answer to a call, and it's a personal answer to somebody, which is individualized. And it's not, there is no way of waiting for the society's answer. Of course, they are very important, but I am the one who answers and who are called. And if I don't answer, it's also an answer which constitutes me. And the way that this is the supremacy of responsibility over freedom in Levinas. And it goes further when he speaks of substitution, because it's also the fact that I could be responsible for the responsibility of the other, even when this other inflicts me harm. That is to say that I'm not guilty, but the bad actions of the others are like a burden which changes from within my innocence. So, and for me, it was very important because, well, Levinas is one of my master, and I come to understand a little bit what he said. When I was thinking of of animals, he was not very interested in such issue. But it's true that for me, the animal cause is important for them, but also it has a strategic dimension. What we are doing to this sentient being that we cannot reduce to machines, what we are doing to them is something that shed lights on us and that reveal who we are. And this is very important. So the responsibility is a very, very strong word, which is a way of reframing our understanding of selfhood, which is not self-centered, which not. And I think it's not connected with the idea of reciprocity. Reciprocity is very important when we speak, for the ethics of care, which, of course, understand asymmetry, but I am responsible for the one who is fragile and vulnerable, who is dependent. But in Levinas, I think it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. I had a personal question to ask you, because you talk a lot, you write a great deal and very eloquently about human relationships to animals. But I was curious whether you might be able to tell us a little bit more about your own personal relationship to animals and how you encounter animals. I mean, I don't suspect that you go to the zoo every Saturday morning,
I don't eat meat.
But for example, do you encounter animals, you know, in forests? And I mean, is that how you, you know, basically bind that relationship?
Yeah.
Or
well, I
or
was
do you have
born.
Pets?
I do have. But I was born in the country, and so I know animals when I was in the country and as a child and so forth. But it's true that I became vegetarian, 25 years ago, for environmental issues, but also for animal welfare. And, well, I have changed my lifestyle because of these issues. But it's true that I spent a lot of time meeting patients and making things in hospitals. My first writings were about end of life and medical ethics. This was a laboratory of the ethics of vulnerability I developed and further deepened. And it's true that during this encounter with very vulnerable people who were dying, people who were dying from cancer and so forth, or who were suffering from Alzheimer's disease or cognitive impairs, I was looking for a kind of ethics which could understand, which could reconfigure autonomy, understand selfhood and autonomy without reducing autonomy to competence, to cognitive capacities. And I came and I reread Levinas in this context and finding in totality and infinity, but above all in otherness and autre manquette, finding the importance of vulnerability as the a passivity, the alteration of my body, but also at the openness to the others, mm-hmm. and the ability to be concerned by the others. And I came back to home, to my house, and I was thinking about that. I was already vegetarian, and then I wanted to know everything, because you cannot speak of vulnerability and at the same time forgetting those who are as vulnerable as us, who mm-hmm. are dying, who are suffering from disease and so forth, and whom we are inflicting excruciating pain. And then I became kidnapped by this cause. I was already vegetarian, but then at this time I did not develop my own approach concerning animal. Mm. It came before, and I was kidnapped by this question, which became something bigger than me, which became something that changes from within all my life.
And it's interesting that you came to this realization by encountering human vulnerability.
Yeah. So being changed by their vulnerability, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and engaging sometimes a mute relationship, yeah. with people suffering from cognitive impairs and their mm-hmm. families, and a lot of things which are very difficult to describe, but which are very important. Mm. And I have worked a lot on death, grieving. And it's true that I think that I understood also that to open the eye and to face the animal suffering, it's so big, it's so painful that I understand that people don't want to see that and repress this.
Right.
Because for me, it was a nightmare. And I understand people who don't want to see this, but this has helped me to write Animal Manifesto, in which I also provide some guidelines that could help us alleviate the animal suffering in a democracy where there are differences of interests and of representations, mm-hmm. and. Because so, but it's true that this work with patients and so forth, and this encounter with the other's vulnerability and with mine, of course, and it's true as framed from within my own approach of mm-hmm. the animal question. Mm.
Thank you so much, Corinne Peluchon. You've given us a lot to think about, and thank you for these very generous and very rich ideas.
Thank you very much.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Programme, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Programme and how we support academic exchanges, research and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.